listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And this evening, we're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And Truth Quest programs are archived at www.gimmesometruth.info. And I've got, if you want to send in emails to the station or any questions, they're at khen.dj@gmail.com. And I also want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And I have a special guest this evening, and he's kind of following up into a series that I've kind of started here that has to do with a subject that isn't necessarily, well, this particular investigator, detective, is got a wide range of investigations, but it started with the John DeCamp and the Franklin cover-up, and then earlier in the year had done an interview with Nick Bryant on the Franklin scandal. And so I've got Jim Rothstein. How do you pronounce that, Jim?
Any way you want to go.
You probably had it said always then, so you don't even correct him anymore. And so what I want to go ahead and say is, why don't you just go ahead and introduce the audience, because now you know more. I didn't get a chance to get your bio that I wanted to be able to read, but I think you can do a better job at it than I can anyway. So just go ahead and fill in our audience as to what your background is.
Well, originally I was born and raised in Minnesota in a town of all of about 250 people, and I ended up going into the United States Navy in 1960, and while I was in the Navy, I sailed the seven seas and got involved in some things, and I went into East Germany as the Berlin Wall was going up and got some people out of there, and then I was at the Bay of Pigs invasion aboard the USS Essex, and technically, we were never there. And then when I got out of the Navy, I went to New York, and I went to work for Chase Manhattan Bank. And eventually, I took the test for the New York City Police Department. And in 1965, February, I was appointed to the New York City Police Department. I went through the police academy, and after I got done with going through the academy, I was assigned to the 16th Precinct, which was Times Square. And for anybody who doesn't know, but back in from 65 to 80, it was probably the wildest place in the world. There was anything and everything you could find was in Times Square. I was first assigned as a patrol officer, and then a pimp killed a cop. And I was the only police officer at the time who had kept any records. At that time, there was a big influx of young prostitutes, young girls who were turned into prostitutes from throughout the United States, and they had a pretty well-organized ring operating throughout the country. And naturally, New York was the center of the whole operation. While I was doing this, I also got involved in the pedophile investigations. And with that, after this all happened, I was assigned to a special investigative unit out of a factory building down on Center Street. While I got down there, that's when I went into the undercover part of this and was able, with the people and the connections I had made, able to infiltrate both the underground pedophile work and prostitution operations that were going on. And from there, I got into anything and everything you could imagine. I ended up arresting Frank Sturgis, one of the Watergate burglars, and also one of the people who was supposedly at the Grassy Knoll in the Kennedy assassination, and a couple other things like that. So that's what got me started. And then in 1980, I was retired.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right. I wasn't sure. It sounded almost like you dropped. So go ahead and go from there. Because that was when your life got exciting, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. But once I was retired, it was right after I had arrested Frank Sturgis, who was the second CIA guy I had, as we used to say, taken down. And they were done with me. They didn't need me anymore. And with that, I went into the, like every good detective in New York goes into the bar and restaurant business. But in the meantime, they never let this die. And as different things came up, the Son of Sam case, I had originally gotten the original information on that in 1969, and he wasn't identified till 78, and I really didn't even know what I had till I ran into Maury Terry, who wrote The Ultimate Evil about the Son of Sam, to find out that I'd actually had the Son of Sam case back then. But once I retired, people kept calling, and all of these cases, some of the things I had worked on, are still coming to light to this day. We had done an investigation into the Vatican scandal, both the pedophile and the Vatican bank scandal, and different things like that. And as you've noticed lately, more and more of this stuff is coming out. So I've been busier than ever. And I also, with the missing children, people started calling me because I had been the only guy, and I had some partners that worked with me over a period of time, but basically I was the only guy that was there the whole time. And I still, to this day, have a very good connections in the underground. And the cases like the Johnny Gosch case, the Jacob Wetterling case, different cases like that, plus what's now known as the Smiley Face Killers, where these young college boys have been drowning or drowned in rivers and killed. I originally had called that the Interstate 9094 cases because after the Son of Sam case was, just before it was exposed, these people started moving west along Interstate 9094, and the last contact I had with anything that I found out, one of the car boys, which was one of Sam Carr's kids, that's where the Son of Sam came from, actually was killed in Minot, North Dakota. And they eventually settled in Kanab, Utah. So this stuff is still going on to this day, and it keeps me rather busy.
Now, when you're saying settled in Kanab, Utah, are you saying that it's kind of an ongoing thing, or am I following you correctly here?
Yes, it is. It has never stopped. There's a whole compound out there. In fact, 3 years ago, one of the people got out of there, and came out here and spent about 3 weeks in the area here and communicated with me and told me everything that was going on. So that gave me another insight, and it all corresponded with the original information I had gotten back in 1969 when I first was sent to Untermeyer Park by an informant and showed where they actually were sacrificing the German shepherds and the children. It keeps going on. These things don't go away because there's never been a real investigation. Even with the arrest of Berkowitz in New York and the Son of Sam case, that was only the tip of the iceberg. They never finished up the investigation. And back in 1997, I was brought back out there by the Yonkers Police Department, which is just north of New York City, and they had reopened the case, but I was only there a couple of days when the word got out that I was back in New York, and there were some very upset people in the police department, so the case never went any further.
In other words, that if it had been investigated and you hadn't been around, they might have let that have gone on a while longer, but since you were there, they knew that you would cut to the chase?
Yes, and the original, like I said, when they originally had the Son of Sam case, one of the people I knew that worked in the forensics unit was a good friend of mine, and he told me they had come upon a serial killer, and it turned out to be the Berkowitz case where they ended up arresting him, but he was not the only guy involved. In the book by Maury Terry, The Ultimate Evil, he fully describes, because he ended up talking to Berkowitz after he was convicted. So we got the rest of the story, and like I said, it coincided with the information that I had.
Now, do you want to explain a little bit more about the Son of Sam? Because, I mean, that happened a while back, right? And so there may be some people that aren't familiar with that particular case.
Well, it was a serial killer Over a period of time, like I said, I first found out about it in 1969 when they were sacrificing. It started with German shepherds, and then it went to kids. And eventually, there were six or eight people killed. By the way, Berkowitz only killed two of those people. The other six people were killed by two guys from Minnesota. So we know it was far bigger and far more involved than what authorities let the public know. And these were ritualistic, satanic killings, all revolving around a thing that came out of the Process Church, which came to the United States around 1965.
And you're saying that this is still continues to this day, or in but it's
yes, it is still, it's going on, it's still continuing in this day, but it has broken off into different types of things. For instance, the smiley face killers, another detective from New York by the name of Gannon actually followed up on some of these killings. I think the latest he's up to about 24, where young college boys end up, for some unknown reason, walking into rivers and drowning. So, and they found these smiley face things at the crime scene. So that is the new name for it. But that's just one part of this. Again, there's many other parts because the actual killings is more around 40 or 50 that I know of.
Okay, I guess maybe I'm being a little bit dense here, but when you're saying this, how do you know that these are tied into the same thing, or is this another umbrella for a type of killings? You want to explain that a little bit further there?
Yes. What it is from the original information I had and from people I've talked to, I have gathered more information on what happened after the Son of Sam, and it fits certain profiles. You know, like when you see a certain type of killing, as an example, but not one of the Son of Sam killings, was when the young boy in Matamoros, Mexico was killed, a young American college kid, there was a reporter at the scene who had heard me speak about some other satanic killings that we had where I'm probably about the only detective or police officer or anybody that's ever interviewed a high priestess. And she had described a crime scene that I had where I had found a cigar, a Cuban cigar, with the teeth marks on the ash end of the cigar. And it made no sense to me. And she described it to me that they use this cigar smoke to cleanse the body. And so when they found, this reporter saw that cigar butt at the crime scene, he knew it was a satanic killing. You know, and that's just like these cases I've been following. They all have a certain pattern, and it evolves over time. Different groups do different things, but you see certain similarities, the way things happen and the way the bodies are found and stuff like that. So there's other killings too, but these are the ones that I can tie to this particular group.
Now, Jim, if I do happen to lose you or anything, I'll call you right back or call you on the phone, because I do know that I detect a little bit of a connection that kind of wants to fade in and out. But so the Son of Sam, does it tie in at all with any of the other, the John DeCamp or Franklin cover-up, or is that just a total separate type of situation where they, you know, you just have these satanic, pedophile, brutal slayings of young people, or anybody is for that matter? Were they all young in the Son of Sam, or?
Yes, they were not as young, real children, not young children like you'll find in the rest of this. But the stuff that's known as the Franklin cover-up and all of that is a segment of this, which we got into. In fact, the original information that John DeCamp had on the Franklin cover-up had been given to me to critique before it went out to make sure that the information was accurate. And so we had been into this long before it ever got there. We had actually, at one point, we found that they were using children to compromise people. And in one instance, three little boys on East 64th Street in New York, two 14-year-olds and a 15-year-old, were murdered. Somebody in an intelligence community was using these children to compromise people. And it was a well-known fact that this was happening. And they killed these. The only problem they had was it was in one of my informant's apartments. And I identified the guy and served him with a subpoena per face-to-face. And by that time, I had been assigned to New York State Select Committee on Crime by the governor and that. But I served him with a subpoena, and it was quashed under national security. And then we had all these different rings that were operating. They all dovetailed. They all worked together. You know, it's like a spider web, or even like an octopus with many tentacles reaching out. And they mix and match and swing and sway back and forth. That's the best way to describe it. And it runs the gamut. It has the pornography end of it, prostitution, you name it, it's in there.
So in other words,
they are all intermeshed.
Okay, so it's kind of more like, you know, if you had mafia or corruption rings, most of them are all going to know whose territory is what, and so they're all going to be aware of who's doing what.
They are all aware of what's going on.
Right.
Once you get into the underground, it's just like a living in a small town. You know everybody, and when I got in there, after a while, I got to know these people. And it was not very complicated to figure out what was going on and who was doing what. I had a very good informant base, because there's another thing that helped me was, as a police officer at the time, I didn't steal their money and beat the daylights out of them, which was customary. And many times I helped these people when they themselves became victims of either extortion or many murder cases and different things like that. And they knew they could trust me, and that's how I was able to really find out what was going on. And that took us into the whole thing in the White House with the pedophiles operating out of the Democratic National Headquarters, which was the Watergate break-in thing. And then we had all of these other different rings of kids being used, which ended up in the Franklin cover-up. And the biggest pedophile ring operating in this country has been going on for 40 years, and there's never been an arrest or prosecution, and that's at St. John's in Collegeville, Minnesota. That place, they have at least admitted, well, they admitted to 13 priests, and there's, in fact, about 40 or so that have been identified, and there's 300-400 victims that we know of. So that means there's another 1,000 or so that we don't know about if the numbers hold the way it usually goes. So this goes all over the place. And like I say, I've been following it for over 40 years now.
Well, this is international, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And then you come into the part where you get the different things. Like, usually it's where there is a revolution or something going on, and you'll find two things happen. It becomes a drug of choice in our country. If we're having turmoil in South America, the drug of choice will be cocaine. If we're over in the Mideast like we are now, it'll be heroin. And you can see that. And then the other part of that is you'll start seeing the girls coming in and being used as prostitutes. So there's patterns that you see over as long as I've been doing it. You begin to see patterns, yes. And it does go all over the world.
Now, I saw something. You started out a paper that you'd sent me on your on a report on organized pedophilia and criminal exploitation of children, and you talk about one group called the Family. Is that one that used to be called the Children of God?
No. The Family, mm-hmm. I only use that to break down the different categories.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Right.
So in the Family, that just denotes the type of situation, for instance, schools and different things that where you have a family atmosphere.
Okay, right.
And they, Yeah.
I see that now. I don't know what I was thinking when I looked at that.
No, I know what you're talking about, yes.
Because there is a family.
No,
there is one called the family.
If I report, the family is only used to denote a segment.
Right, and because my understanding is that was one that, or the writing that I was reading, the article I was reading about had to do with one that came out of South America. And yeah, and may have tied in with River Phoenix, maybe?
Yeah, it was in through some of that. I remember that. But no, that has nothing to do with this.
Okay, right. But while we're at it, when we're talking about the family, because you do say there's different types of you're using it in the term of pedophilia, or you put it in a broader term than that?
No, this here is basically for the pedophilia.
Okay.
And I break it down into the family, the homosexual, which has nothing to do per se with the homosexual lifestyle. Then you have the commercial, you have the serial killers, and then you have the occult. That's how you break that down.
Okay, when you're talking about commercial aspects, what is, when they're trafficking in these children, what kind of figures are you seeing for what they sell them at, prices for?
Well, we know in many cases it can be as little as a couple hundred dollars. Most of the time it's $2,500 to $25,000, or it'll go higher. At one time we had a young guy, I caught up with him four or five times, but every time I got him and put him in jail, somebody let him out. But he would actually ride around the United States with a Winnebago, buying, selling, and kidnapping kids. You would put your order in, and then he would go get you what you wanted. And in other cases, like in the Johnny Gosch case now, we know for a fact there were four boys taken in that particular operation. And I believe in that operation, the guy was a customer, was paying any from $2,500 to $5,000 for the kid that they were getting. So there are various amounts that are paid. Some guys will pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to get just the kid they want.
Now, on some of these, was within the Johnny Gosch case, were they just kind of driving around neighborhoods and picking out certain kids, or was it a paper boys, or was there anything kind of profile there that particularly fit with what happened with that particular case?
Most definitely. Johnny Gosch was the first boy taken. He was a newspaper boy. And how they worked this, and I know this for a fact because many times I personally observed when these things were being set up. Usually it starts off with a customer that wants a certain type of a kid. And he has to be at a certain age where certain sexual developments are fit a specific request. And then what they do, once they set the kid up and they know who they want and the customer says, that's the guy I want, then they go in and grab him, like they did in the Johnny Gosch case. We know that they were watching him. Then in the second case, we even know that the police were told that the Martin boy was going to be kidnapped. He was also a newspaper boy. And they knew he was going to be kidnapped, what day he was going to be taken and everything, and they didn't do anything about it. Then the Allen boy was taken, and in that case, too, we're just finding out, because the family has never talked, and just within the last week or so, they have spoken to Noreen Gosch, which is just a miracle that we made that connection. And then when they took the Wetterling boy in Minnesota, what happened there was they were supposed to take the newspaper boy in St. Joseph, Minnesota, a guy that I interviewed, as he'll remain anonymous at this time. But I personally interviewed him, and he said, yes, they tried to grab me, but I slipped out of my coat and ran away. And so the alternate guy to grab was a kid named Jacob Wetterling. So I have also verified this information with an interview I did with one of our people from the intelligence community, that when Johnny Gosch was kidnapped, they did an investigation from 1982 to 1989 There were 20 men assigned to this investigation, and what they found out was that actually 834 children had been taken into this particular type of kidnapping over that period of time. There were actually 1,500 kidnappings, but 834 fit in to this one type of kidnapping. And so this is what happened there. And the other part of this is none of these cases were ever, ever investigated. And you can let anybody tell you or any police department that they did an investigation, and I will tell you that they're lying, because there's information out there that I personally know of that has never, ever been followed up, even after the police authorities were told about it.
So, I mean, these boys were some of the first milk carton boys, correct? I mean,
yes, that goes way
back to the, what, 80s?
Yeah, 82 was when Johnny Gosch was taken.
And to this day,
they're not doing anything about it.
But his mother is still active at trying to, she's already met up with him somewhere along the line. But
yes.
what is she trying to do now in continuing
on?
I
just spoke to her today. About 3 weeks ago, I went down to West Des Moines, Iowa, to film a television program that's supposed to air sometime in February called Vanished, where they actually are looking at the case again, as they are at some of the other missing children. And it was a very good show. How much is going to get on the air, we don't know yet. But just in the last couple of days, there's been some new information that's come forward. Noreen, especially working with me and others, has never stopped looking. And what's really amazing is she is one of the few mothers in the United States that has not given up looking for her child and believing that law enforcement is doing a good job. In fact, at one point when the FBI was talking to her and trying to con her, she took a hot cup of coffee, cup and all, and threw it right in the agent's face and told him to quit lying to her. So she's not well liked by the FBI, but she has never, ever stopped looking for that boy. And you brought up the thing that he came home to visit. Now, all the cops use that as well. Why didn't she call the police? If you know what happens in this underground, if you have any idea at all, that answer is so simple, it's unbelievable. When these children are taken, if you don't get to them within the first 72 hours, and then you better know what you're doing, they will be gone forever. And there's been other children that have come back. There's a young boy from Painesville, Minnesota, that disappeared many years ago. About 7-8 years ago, he showed up for about 2 hours in town and left again. But Johnny Gosch, before that boy went home, there was a meeting in Chicago where one of my people that I have been talking to from the inside actually got called out of retirement to go to Chicago to meet with Johnny's handlers and lay out the rules of what he was to do when he went to see his mother. He was not alone when he went there.
You know, that what's interesting is when you say 72 hours, because that's how long it takes them to convince them to never go back. And some summer, I mean, you can get into that a little bit further. But I find that, isn't that the length of time that they also require that a child is missing before they even let you really do anything about it?
They're supposed to start looking immediately. That's a con job when they tell you, we got to give us 72 hours. If a kid's missing, the key to a missing kid, every minute that goes by makes it 10 times more likely that you're not going to find him. I mean, it's the biggest, you know, that's a con game. That's cops not doing their job. In fact, in a proposal that I have for legislation, I say that if a police officer or anybody involved in any type of agency does not immediately react to a report, should go to jail for 1 year. So we can get into that later or some other program, but there are ways to handle this stuff. But you got to look for these kids right away.
Okay, I'm speaking with Jim Ross, Rothstein, and he's a retired New York detective, but you're pretty much an active investigator now for missing children and on pedophilia cases, and but you've gone into a lot of other cases too, correct? But
yes,
this,
I have.
But this
I,
is your...
I'm still very much involved, and I don't call myself an investigator.
Okay.
I'm a researcher and consultant, because researchers and consultants don't need licenses.
Oh, okay.
And I won't be bound by any of their crap, because you could never do an investigation if you have to do some of the things that they do to control this.
Right. And why don't you get into a little bit of what you're doing is kind of dangerous in its own right, too, because, I mean, and that's why partly why you're finding that it's so tough to get some of these cases followed up. I mean you'll get a certain distance, and then when it gets up to a certain level, you can't go any higher. And you want to go into explain that a little bit?
Well, I don't think it's so dangerous, because there are rules out in the street, and I've always believed in those rules. They're not written down like they are in the law book, and they don't go to court. They have a whole different set of rules. And as long as you play by the rules, you're honest, you don't take payoffs, and you don't use your information to coerce or to compromise somebody, you got to have some respect out there, because, you know, someday the guys that are on the bad side need your help too. In fact, just to show you that one of my best informants was probably the worst pedophile I ever met in my life. As a young boy, he had been molested in Brooklyn, New York, in a foster care, and he became probably the worst pedophile that I ever met. He was a murderer, extortionist, and yet when he got older and he found out that I could be trusted, he took me into this underground and probably helped save more children, because he realized what he had done. And so, yes, there is danger, but I know the rules and I play by them. So
you haven't run into some of the same things that Ted Gunderson has run into, as far as...
Yeah. Oh, very much so, because I knew I've met with Ted already. I met John DeCamp. I'm the senior guy in this. Like I said, I've been doing this since I got started in 1969. And when I first got into the police department is when I started keeping records of the girls that were moving at that time, the young kids that were being kidnapped. So actually, I've been doing this since 65. And I've met anybody and everybody who's ever been involved with this. And basically, like John DeCamp and Ted Gunderson and them, they have had many cases. Many of them come off of the different things that I had worked, and they've done a tremendous job.
Now, one of the things about why this seems to be such an important subject to talk about is because of the fact that this never ends, right?
No, and it's getting worse every year. Number one, I call it the biggest terrorism we have in our country. It's far worse than anything else you've ever seen. There are many, many families and children wrecked by this. These poor kids, when they get into it, have no chance. And there has been very, very few investigations done. The FBI just did one here a while back. They did a tremendous job where they took a bunch of them down. And in 1971-72, the New York City Police Department, the FBI, the IRS, and a bunch of other federal agencies, plus a number of cities around the United States, we picked the 12 biggest pimps operating at the time in moving girls and that. And we investigated, and we convicted 11 of the 12 biggest pimps in the United States. So it proves that it can be done. We didn't go after the little guys. I never do that. I always went for the biggest. And in fact, at the time, I had a book where I had all these guys profiled in. And, you know, if you were on the front page of the book, it was known that you were going to go to jail. So these guys would do anything to get off the front page.
So you must have an incredible amount of street smarts to be able to get around and work within the community and go after these type of people, because from what I understand, I mean, this sort of thing goes up to some very high positions of around the world, correct?
Yes, we had prime ministers, we had senators, we had congressmen, we had judges, you name it, big businessmen, all of that, every which way you could imagine. And in the military, people, there was no limit. And that's why another big facet of this is what we call human compromise, where they use children to compromise people. That's probably, next to the pornography end of it, is probably the biggest thing that's done with this. It's very lucrative if you can tie somebody up with a young boy and get pictures and different things like that. You control this guy. Now, many people think this extortion is only for money. Wrong. They use it for power. If you have an individual that you have compromised in position, you can make him do whatever you want. And there were many cases we had into some very powerful parts of our government that were compromised.
Why do you think, is it fairly easy for them to do that? Or how can they have so many people taken in by this?
Well, the way I used to look at it, the way it was told to me is that, again, this is street language, is people with fast money will eventually end up, first they go with the hookers, and you can see congressmen and governors and everybody get nailed with that, and then they finally end up working their way into kids, and eventually somebody sets them up, and they think they're immune. They think they're, and many times they are immune from prosecution, because a lot of the cases we worked never got to see the light of day.
And these have been some pretty big involved cases. I mean, actually, I'm embarrassed because until I read your paper, I wasn't aware of the St. John's. I'd heard of the other cases, the McMartin and Franklin scandal and these other ones, but that one was new to me.
See, and then the other part of this is when we did the investigation into the Vatican. In 1978, when John Paul I was made the Pope, I actually was one of the two detectives. Well, there were two of us that had been assigned to the State Select Committee on Crime, and we were the two detectives that were assigned to work with Father Bruce Ritter, who ran the Covenant House in New York. And John Paul I gave him a special dispensation to clean the pedophiles out of the Vatican and to clean out the Vatican Bank. And we were the two detectives assigned to that. And 10 days later, the Pope was dead. And we had an informant from the Vatican at the time out of the Legion of Christ who told us that the Pope had, in fact, been murdered. So I also did. We did a very deep investigation into the Vatican and the involvement and how that was done and the different things with the Catholic Church. And as you see over the last couple of years, starting out with Boston and all, Father Porter and all of them, it's become a major thing. And there's been a big break in Ireland where they finally got the Pope again now trying to cover all this stuff up.
And he goes, this particular Pope goes way back. Does some of this child trafficking and that sort of thing go back and tie into a lot of other criminal behaviors too? So, I mean, you kind of find them intertwined?
Oh, most definitely. Like in the Vatican Bank scandal, at one time I was privy to some information which clearly showed that, like at the end of World War II, and this stuff is just breaking 3 weeks ago, the New York Times ran a big story about an investigation that leaked out into the Nazi involvement with the Vatican and certain parts of our intelligence community. And that all dovetailed through what we were doing. So, oh, yes, this very much figures into all of that.
I mean, because the current Pope goes back to that period of time.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. That's a whole another five shows if you want to go into all of that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I know we'll barely scratch the surface of the stuff that you, I'm sure you had to run across, particularly with the length of time you've been involved in detective work. I know that. Where would you like to go with this I did an interview last week with John DeCamp, and he's gotten to be involved in a number of cases, but were you involved in many of the cases that he was that were, you know, that were outside of this parameter of the Franklin cover-up, or?
Well, yes, because the Franklin cover-up was just one part of the bigger picture. And like I said, the original report that went to John DeCamp, the original findings, was a very small part of it. And like I said, it was sent to me to critique before it went out. So somebody, and I know who it was because I know who sent me the information to go over it to make sure it was all accurate. And then the Franklin cover-up got blown out of the water when John DeCamp went after it. The thing that John DeCamp was looking at was one part of this, and it was a big part. And John did a very good job on it. And it just shows you how big this is when it was still only a small part of it.
I did an interview a couple of times with Kevin Annett, and he's been working with the Native Americans in Canada and exposing the situation with the Native children being put in some of these schools and the religious, well, there he's part of them involved in going over to Ireland trying to confront the Pope. So, again, this thing is not new, and it doesn't sound like it's going to go away anytime soon, but until people start really exposing the fact that, I mean, these kids that have been taken in to do this sort of thing, they end up being the perpetrators in the end a lot of times, correct?
Oh, most definitely. If they survive and live through it, once they are to the point where nobody wants them anymore as a toy, then they themselves will start recruiting kids, and then they'll start abusing them. And it's an evil cycle that don't stop. Because, like I said, once they get brainwashed, they're in it. And we were able to, again, I always like to cite specific cases so I know what I'm talking about. We had a guy by the name of Ben Rose, one of the most notorious pedophiles, and he also would supply little boys to the United Nations. But Ben Rose, when I grabbed him or caught him, he had gotten three boys from Maryland and brought them up to New York. And we did some observations on him. In fact, it took us over a week, a day and night following him. When we caught the three boys, if it hadn't been the detectives that it was that knew what was going on, those kids, even after we saved them, would have never been able to survive. And we got to them, and we knew how to talk to them. We knew how to deal with them. And then Ben Rose became probably the best, if not one of my top 10 informants, and took us into the highest levels of this. In fact, he was known as Dr. Rockefeller. When I got my first information, that's what his name was in the underground.
So is he still alive?
No, he died a number of years ago. And what they did with him is, at a certain point right after I retired, I was down at Forlini's restaurant down in New York, and Ben Rose was there with his lawyer, and I had already retired, and I went over and I talked to him, asked him how he was and that, and he says, well, I'm going to prison. And I says, Ben, you don't have to go to prison. All you got to do is give me the word and you ain't going. He says, no, I got to go. And why that is, they had to destroy his credibility. Certain people did not want him talking and telling it. So what they do, they put him in jail for a year and a half. He's discredited, and it makes no difference. It's just like one of my other informants, the guy that was in charge of that investigation where they found the 834 children. He did about a year and a half in prison, oh, 2-3 years ago, so he's totally discredited. And this is the way it goes.
But he's not discredited to you, is he?
No, because I deal with these people. You know, mm-hmm. I know who they are. You don't, Like one night, again, I like to give a case. They were complaining I was spending too much money and drinking too much, working, you know. So I went to St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York, bought a six-pack, and sat on the front steps for 8 hours and turned in a report that I observed no crime and had expended very little money. And I said the moral of the story was you don't go to the church looking for the bad people, which I was wrong at. You know, I really could have turned around because the cardinal at that time was one of the big pedophiles in the world, and he was known to as Nelly out in the street. So, but it was a point to be made. You know, you didn't find these people. You had to go in the gutters to find them.
Now, you ran into that cardinal in numerous aspects, didn't you? More than one case.
Yeah, and I had an informant, and I can give his name. He's dead. It's Skull Murphy, Ed Murphy. He's the one that gave me one of the boys that the cardinal had molested that ended up getting arrested and going to court, and the cardinal forgave him, and, you know, they got him for burglary. And he gave me that guy so that in case the cardinal didn't want to play by my rules, that I could, you know, expose him too. So that's how I stayed clear of Cardinal Spellman, but he knew me very well.
Now, he's not alive anymore either, is he?
Oh, he's dead. He died many years ago.
Okay. Was he quite a bit older then than the current pope?
He was a cardinal.
Oh.
And he was probably the most powerful guy. He was the most powerful guy in the United States because he was the cardinal in New York.
Right.
And tremendous, tremendous power. And the pope now is a little younger than he was, but this guy, Ratzinger, was definitely involved at the end of the Second World War and that, very much involved.
Uh-huh. Now, when they get these kids, do they use a lot of mind control techniques on them?
You don't need mind control. All you got to do is get them to believe that if anything happens, they're going to kill you, their parents. And then the degradation they go through. You got to remember a kid at that time, they have a way of conditioning them. I don't call it brainwashing. It's conditioning. And at that age, you know, you're just getting into where you know what you're supposed to, what you're made of. And in the Navy, they said, any port in a storm, well, that's what this is. And then all of a sudden, they realize that they've been taken for anything and everything, and there's no place to go. I watched it happen. I mean, I personally and interviewed many of these kids and the people who did it to tell me how it happened and what they did. Sometimes I swore there was a manual written on how to coerce these kids and get them to go along with the program.
I mean, because now, did you, when you were talking about the Gosch case, did you believe that he might have been Jeff Gannon at all, or?
Absolutely not, because at the beginning when that started, anything is possible, except for one thing. Nick Bryant went down there. I asked Nick to go down to Washington to confront Gannon, and he did. Gannon is about 5'6", 5'7", or so, and Johnny Gosch would be at least 6'4". And I don't care who you are this day, you can't move from 5'6", 7", or 8" to 6'4". It just don't happen. So that's how Noreen and myself found out that Jeff Gannon could not be Johnny Gosch.
So you worked quite a bit with Nick Bryant too, then. And I mean, he was at that investigation for quite a while. Is he still?
Oh yeah, but he's a newcomer.
Is he still involved at all, or did he just move on?
I just talked to him the other day. Yes, he is, and his book is out, and he sent me a copy of it. I find it very interesting.
Well, great. And so I guess what I would like to do is to – there's one in here that you were talking about, a Willie Dunn and a Bronfen kidnapping. Do you want to elaborate on that one a little bit, or is there
– Willie Dunn is the guy that was driving around the country in the Winnebago. And what happened was at one point, Edgar Bronfman's boy, Sammy, staged his own kidnapping. He wanted money to open up a gay disco, and the old man wouldn't give him the money. So he staged his own kidnapping, and two guys went to jail over that, Mel Patrick Lynch and Dominic Byrne. And we did a big investigation in that, and just a couple of years ago, I actually ran into one of the FBI agents who had that case. And, yes, I know very much about Willie Dunn. In fact, the very first time I had Willie Dunn was on 45th Street in New York when I was a rookie cop. And through my whole career, I ran into him a couple of times. And every time we put him in jail, somebody let him out.
Now, when we get back to these, there's human intelligence is one of your areas of this type of crime. And do you want to explain that one a little bit further? I mean, because you get into Michael Reconosciuto, is that?
Yep, that's who he is. Very interesting case. Human intelligence is also human compromise. And what they do is they use children to compromise people. And Reconosciuto gets involved in the Promise software and all of that. He's currently in prison. And the reason he's there, he knows too much. But Reconosciuto, as a very young boy, got involved. And I had started talking to him, and I became aware that what he was describing to me fit a profile. So I said to him at one point, I said, "You must have been a chicken." And he said, "How do you know that?" So I told him. He says, "Oh yeah, that's how I got started." And you know, that's just how this thing goes. And human intelligence, you look at the Watergate break-in. Everybody thinks the Watergate break-in was set up by Nixon and all of that. Very few people know the truth. The truth about that was, and I told you, I arrested Frank Sturgis, who was one of the Watergate burglars, years later in New York. And I know for a fact that the detective, Carl Schauffler, who made the arrest on the Watergate break-in, knew the day before at noon already who was going to do the break-in and what they were after. Besides the prostitution ring operating out of the Democratic National Headquarters was a pedophile operation. And they have what we call a book, where they have all their customers in with what they pay and what they want. Well, those guys, when they were going to break in there, they needed that, because at every Democrat, every Republican, and every power broker in Washington who was using kids in the book, and they would have had tremendous, you know, look at the human intelligence you would have got out of that. You could have compromised half this country. That's what that's all about.
Now that's even the ones that are really, I mean, there's got to be some out there that aren't compromisable, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. They're not all compromised, but there's a lot of them. And they're very selective who they pick and who they compromise. I confronted many of these people face to face. And they knew I knew who they were.
Uh-huh. So, you're in continuing on with this. What is it that about this investigating that keeps you going? I mean,
it's when mothers like Noreen Gosch call, or like here, I have right now a girl who is a victim from St. John's. When she was 36 years old, about 10 years ago, so that makes her about 46 now. She had come home, and I had just met her father. And her father called me up on a Sunday night and said, "My Lizzie is coming home. She's going to commit suicide." And when I got there, she was down in the basement, and they had a stove where you could see the flames. And she was getting ready. And I've seen this before. And I talked her out of it. She's alive to this day yet. But she was a victim of abuse by a priest, the most horrendous abuse. There were this priest alone, I'd say, at least abused 50, 60 children, males and females. This guy didn't make a difference. As long as they were kids, he abused them, and it was all covered up. But this is what makes me do it. When I can help somebody like that, it's a big thing. And a lot of these victims, the ones that don't stay in it and survive, they don't find anybody. I had a 55-year-old man about 6 months ago come and call me to meet with him. And I met him at a restaurant. We sat down and talked. And after about 20 minutes, he said, you know, he says, you're the first guy I've ever talked to that knows any, you know, understands what I'm talking about. I said, what's that? He says, I was molested as a boy. And he said, nobody ever believed me. My family told me to shut up. He was molested by a priest. And I sat there and talked to him. And the tears came out, down running down his cheeks. All his life he had lived with this. Nobody understood him. And that's why I do it, because somebody's got to help these people. You know, there's nobody that does.
Now, when are you familiar with the Kathy O'Brien case? Or
very much so.
Okay, and had you worked with this that one at all, or
no?
No,
and I won't go into it, but I very well know who she is.
Uh-huh.
I believe that some of the things she talks about are true, but she has somebody else involved with her that I do not associate with people like that.
Okay.
That have agendas other than honorable.
Okay. All right. And but one of the things that, I don't know whether this was true or not, but it was brought up in one of the interviews, because there's actually several interviews with Alex Merklinger, I believe, that's on the internet.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they're really good interviews. He did a whole week with you and John DeCamp and Noreen Gosh and Ted Gunderson, and getting into the fact that sometimes the parents are involved in some of these situations, correct?
Oh, yes, many times. That's always one of the things you got to look at, either through hardship or compromise. I have one case where I know the father was into kids, and I believe that at one point he set his own son up to be kidnapped, and the kid has never been seen again. Yes, that does happen, and it happens more than most people want to believe.
Okay, and did you feel like any of that was involved with a possibility with, you know, Noreen's husband, or did that?
I have seen no evidence of it. Mm-hmm. Although there's a very strained relationship there, which is understandable, and in many cases that's what happens. You know, everybody blames everybody
mm-hmm.
when the kid disappears, especially when the cops don't do their job. It just wrecks everything. And I have not seen any evidence that either one of them, especially Noreen, the husband is, or the father of the boy, you hear very little about it. And it's always amazed me that there wasn't more done into seeing what that connection was. And I've never spoken to him.
Uh-huh. Okay. What makes you continue to follow up on some of these leads and other ones that you don't? I mean, because there's... what kind of criteria that you follow that makes something more likely to be a place to go down? I mean, it's just experience, your gut feelings?
Well, I usually, there's no case that I have ever touched that I will not keep up with if I get information in that. A lot of it has to do with how much the people want to do. You'll find it very strange, but many people, let's put it behind us. We don't want to talk about it. I could never quite understand that. But when we were doing our investigations, at one point when the governor of the state of New York appointed me to the New York State Select Committee on Crime over the police commissioner and the mayor's head in New York City, I had a partner by the name of Matty Rosenthal that went with me. And during our investigation, we had brought in all kinds of experts in this, and one of them was the Policy Science Corporation, which was headed by Harold Laswell, who had studied under Freud. And he was very much into this to work out the psychological part of this and why these things happen. And like I said, we looked at every avenue you could possibly think of to solve these cases, because we got some of the worst unsolvable cases you could ever think of. And he made a very strange statement to me one time. Not strange, but I asked him, I says, you know, Harold, I says, I've been working on this for years, and there's just some things you can't get to court. It's covered up and this and that. I says, is there any hope to stop this? And he says, yes, there is, Jim. He says, the only way you can ever stop what's going on, the mothers and the women involved or who are the victims and their children are taken, must make the men and fathers do what they're supposed to do to protect their children. He says, till that happens, he says, you will never get this thing accomplished. And, you know, the more I've done this, it's over 40 years now, I find that true because, like I say, when I go to battle on this, there's only one person that stands up, Noreen Gosh.
Okay, let me say this is KHEN LP 106.9 Salida, and this is Truth Quest with Melody. And my guest this evening is Jim Rothstein, and he is a detective, okay, a retired detective, but not really retired.
Well, I think I'm retired because I don't put in 20 hours a day, 7 days a week anymore. When we were doing these investigations, we worked. We didn't get overtime. You just worked, you know, and you'd sometimes be gone on something for days on end. And that's how you solve these cases.
So were you married?
I was at one time, yes, and I never blamed her for leaving because at one time the police department went to her and told her if she would testify that I came home drunk and beat the kids and her, she would never have to work again because they were trying to get me to back off and I wouldn't do it. So about that time she decided that there was no reason that since I wasn't going to quit, that she didn't have to put up with that. And I will tell you, it is amazing how she stood up and would never say that because it wasn't true. So there you pay a price for this stuff. There were none of us guys. Every one of us ended up being divorced.
So it is Noreen Gosh. I mean, she had to have threats herself, right? And I mean, and her marriage took a toll too, didn't it?
Oh yes, it did. It does many, many times. Most of the time, it does. Noreen, I know her very well. Like I said, I was just down in Iowa with the filming of that and was with her and her present husband. We had dinner together. She's just the salt of the earth. What they have done to her is absolutely cruel. Many of the false hopes and then the lies and insinuations that people put out to try to discredit her is just amazing. For instance, there were three photographs that showed up one night, and she got them on her front door and on the computer. I had a copy of it, and so did one other gentleman. There were three of us that got the same photos. And right away, they're saying that she did it and all that. Well, I know that's crap, because I had been working 2 years to get these pictures. And at the same time those three photos showed up, there were 600 more pictures in Omaha, Nebraska. And I had 48 hours, I think it was 48 or 72 hours or something like that, to get there to get these pictures. The only thing, some of them pictures depicted pedophilia. And if I would have picked them up without law enforcement, I'll guarantee you they'd arrested me for possession of child pornography. And when I couldn't get there, the pictures went back underground. Nobody bothers to mention the rest of the story. And they have gone so far as to say that Noreen made that up.
No. When did this happen? Was this not too many years ago, or?
Yeah, a couple years ago. About 3-4 years ago.
Yeah, it seems like I remember those pictures going around. Yeah.
That took a lot of work to get those pictures, let me tell you. And then these people, and the cops even made the statements. And I personally met with one of the detectives in West Des Moines, Iowa, and he had a meet with me on his off-duty hours. Because if you go down to West Des Moines and try to get information on the case, they will never let you talk to the detectives. They have some lieutenant who does the damage control and lays out the story they want you to hear.
Well, do you want to get in? Because these are all covered up, not just, I mean, through these departments and various, I mean, this is such a high, when I'm going to go up high, so high in government, it's just, it doesn't matter. You find dead ends, are they getting covered up in how many different areas? Who usually puts the kibosh on it?
Well, that's interesting. It comes from every direction. When you get to a certain level, being honest gets to be very tough. You find the criminals, you have perfect cases. For instance, in one time, again, I like to use actual cases, I had the best wiretap information I had ever gotten on a case, and we went to the Manhattan District Attorney to get the wiretap order on a nationwide pedophile ring at the highest levels, and which is all was part of the Franklin cover-up, and Nick Bryant goes into it a little bit with a operation that went up to Massachusetts with Greg Spence and that. Well, we went to get this wiretap, and we were turned down for the wiretap. And my partner really was pretty wild that day and made some statements that only we could get away with. And then the district attorney sent his investigators to bust the place to get the information so we couldn't get it. So that's what you run into. And many of the other cases, when you get to the very top, you can't get a prosecutor, or the information is such that you can't get the witnesses you need. They're dead, they die, that type of thing. So this is what happens.
Now,
and the cover-up comes from right, from where? From the most powerful people in the world.
And you find a lot of them are actually involved in it. It isn't just, you know, a setup so that they are compromised. I mean, there's...
Oh, no. A lot of them are in it very willingly. This is just the way the world is. When you get that power, people who get incensed with the power they have think they're above the law, and many times they are. And they'll end up with kids. For some reason, they gravitate to the kids to show that they're so strong at that, and yet they have to bend down to using kids. It's amazing. But you touched on something else, the thing with what can't happen. First of all, any police officer, may he be a local cop, may he be a state agent, or in any branch of the federal government, when they do one of these cases, it's the end of their career. I have never, ever run into anybody who has survived an investigation like this. When you get done, you're finished. You make one case, even if it don't go to court, you're done. And that's what we have to stop. We have to get the people to back the few good cops that do these cases and put their careers and everything online.
When you made a statement earlier about having the dads do what they need to do, what is that they need to do? And how do we educate people to prevent, to help keep their kids out of being picked up in these instances?
Well, it's just like what we're doing right now is the first step. You got to get the people out there, because most people do not believe that this really happens. When they hear the Noreen Gosh story, the Jacob Wetterling case, the Allens, the Martins, and I, the Eaton Patz cases, I mean, I can go on and on. They really don't believe that it's happening. It don't happen to me. It's not going to happen to me. They're wrong. It happens to everybody. And every child that disappears, there's another family that has to worry about it. And the thing is, if we all got together, every family, every father and mother stood up and made the cops do what they're supposed to do, this wouldn't be allowed to go on. And then what we have to do is get them to go to their politicians and pass a few laws that would make sure that this stuff could not happen. It'd be very simple.
How many kids do you think have been gotten involved in this sort of thing? How big do you think it is? And just in this country, and maybe worldwide.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, you got to go by the different categories. There's at least 250 children a year who disappear into this subculture that live and survive and thrive in it. You know, once they get done with it, and again, I'll use a case. We had a case in New York where a young man found his, I guess he was about 27, 28, and he found his lover cheating on him, so he committed suicide on his front steps at a Bojess restaurant. And we found out that that young man had, in fact, been kidnapped when he was 13 years old out of Texas. So this is why I say you follow up on this, you know. And that's how you know what's going down.
Okay, now one category I didn't really see in there, and I don't know whether what you think on that, is putting him into slavery.
Well, yes. Well, that comes in. That well, you can get into the serial end of it. The slavery part of it, every pimp, every hooker out there is a slave to somebody.
Okay.
That's how it works. And especially in the pedophile world, if there's some guy with a kid. And many of these guys, now here's something that I mentioned in my thing too, is where these kids are kidnapped and the guy that kidnaps them convinces the kid that he's really doing something good for him, that he's better off than where he was at his home. And in many instances, I had a case once where this girl was had become a prostitute, and I told the family she's better off being a hooker than going back with you folks, you know. And I was that way. I put it the way it was. But it's a strange world, and some of these families, you just wonder what's going on.
And this going back to the Kathy O'Brien situation, not knowing all of what was true or not, but if you had parents that could literally, you know, have children to give out in this sort of scenario, do you run into this?
Yes, I have. There's a case up in Maine where I was up there, and two priests came to me where a young lady had come to them, and they wanted to sacrifice her kid, a young baby. And this was the type of thing it was. She at one time had been involved, and it didn't happen. We stopped it. But, yes, that I have run into that. It's not as prevalent as people think it is. But when you have these, and I get into that, too, with the cults and stuff, That is exactly what that is. You know, you have all these different wacko things that are going on. And, yes, that happens. It certainly does.
Okay, do you think it's more or less prevalent in other parts of the world?
Oh, yes. That's a tough one because it's prevalent all over the place. Different cultures, you know, it's some of it they just figure it's part of real life, you know. That has to do a lot with the various different religious beliefs, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what is the story behind the finders? Were you involved in that one?
Yes, I was. In fact, I happened to be in Washington, D.C. When I did this report, I had prepared this report for a bipartisan congressional investigation that was going to take place. And I just happened to be in Washington making my presentation when Customs, the guy that was running it was a former Customs agent, and everybody in law enforcement knew he was the guy to call. And I just happened to be in the office when the call came in from the Customs people about the finder's sale. And so right away they put me up with, you know, to look at it all and that. Yes, I know every bit about it. A lot of the stuff you see on the finders now is not the original information.
Hmm.
You know, people have taken it and added and detracted and subtracted. But I talked to some of the agents that were actually involved. And the other part of this is at the same time while I was down there, a young man called in totally off just besides himself. His little child had been in a daycare, and he was a member of some part of our intelligence community, and they actually had found a chip implanted in the child's nose. And when he called me, and they put me on the phone with him. I explained to him, and he was telling me about all his friends would be working on this. And I said, no. I says, you better look at them, because if anybody did it, it was those people that did it. And I never heard from them again. But the Finder's case is as real can be, and it's going on to this day just like it was going on then.
Okay, and that is, you want to explain a little bit about what that?
They had, basically they were running kids up and down the coast, and they got caught, but it goes back to the case I described where I had this intelligence guy when they killed the two little boys on East 64th Street in New York, which is in my report. But it was in my partner's apartment, and we identified, and I served him with a subpoena, and it was covered up under national security. It was the same type of operation. The same thing, they were using kids, and they just got caught.
Okay, now do you think sometimes that maybe this is more, that there's this part of this could be a government operation?
Well, certainly. It's
okay.
Called human compromise.
Okay,
that's what
I'm trying to say is more like there might be more involved in other aspects than just pedophilia or sex rings and whatever. Have you run across any other type of scenario that's involved with this?
Oh, most certainly. That's why I talk about that 64th Street. At the time when they were fighting the evil communist empire, anything could be done. And they used children. And that's why I ask, what part of the National Security Act allows us to kill our children? And it doesn't. And that's why after we nailed him that time, there was a big movement on, and that's why there was a big investigation done in 1982 to basically make sure that this wasn't going to get out, that they were using kids. And this happens at every level, and it happens in the business world where they use kids. There's a whole, all these runaways, like I open up in my statement, is you have all these kids floating around. They're lost. They're throwaways. And you can use and abuse them, and nobody will ever know about it. Other than when we were working there and actually worked with the kids, there was nobody watching them. You have many of, I call them candy stores, social services, these schools for kids, just like the McMartin stuff and that. Happens all the time, and it's going on to this day. And that's where the pedophiles operate out of. Nobody watches them.
Some of these schools are rather large operations. I was just looking up some of these, and I'm not saying that they're necessarily involved in the pedophilia, yep. But I just couldn't believe how some of these schools are. I mean, they're whole cities.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And this is why you have to be careful, because if I was going to destroy them, all I'd do is get a couple of pedophiles in there, and it wouldn't take long. You know, you could destroy the whole school, and they do that. I can prove from documents I saw and from information I have, that's what happened in the Catholic Church at the end of World War II. There were people, and the names come right out in my report where I mentioned how they got involved with it and actually put pedophiles into the church. I personally know the Russian end of it that got into the church to do this, because what's the easiest way to destroy the church? It was prone for it anyhow, but you help it along a little bit, you know? And that is what happened.
Well, when you first opened the show, you mentioned something a bit about how you retired, when you retired, you were involved in a case that wasn't really involved with this subject. And, I mean, I know there's a whole lot more we can cover on this, but I also would kind of like to acquaint my audience somewhat with some of your other cases, because they're every bit as interesting, although ultimately, they still tie in one way or the other. And I think part of more than anything is just being able to hold these public figures and others accountable. But if you want to explain a little bit about the Frank Sturgis story.
You just touched on a very important point. Very few people ever pick up on that. What it is I was working the pedophiles and stuff, and I end up arresting Frank Sturgis when he came to New York. Now, Frank Sturgis was CIA. He was part of Op 40. Frank Sturgis had been in the Bay of Pigs invasion. I had been in the Bay of Pigs invasion. And Frank Sturgis was in the Watergate break-in. He was one of the burglars. And he came to New York while I was doing these investigations. Like I said, we infiltrated what I call the shadow government with this going into the kids. And I got an anonymous phone call, which I used to get a lot of, that Frank Sturgis was coming to New York to assassinate Marita Lorenz. Marita Lorenz had been the lover of Fidel Castro. She had a son by him. And then she was sent in to kill Fidel by Sturgis and the Op 40 people. And when she got there, the cyanide pills or whatever the junk was she had dissolved in the face cream, so she couldn't kill him. So she stayed with him because they had been lovers. And Castro knew why she was there, and then he shipped her back to this, you know, let her go. But Marita was there when they planned the Kennedy assassination. And when Marita was going to testify at the House assassination hearings, Sturgis called her up and said, "Marita, you know what the rules are. If you testify, you know what's going to happen." Well, Marita decided she was going to testify. So Sturgis came to New York to kill her. And when he came in, me and my partner were waiting for him, and we arrested him. And we had him 2 hours before anybody in the police department knew we had him. And we debriefed him for 2 hours. And when he found out that I had been in the Bay of Pigs aboard the USS Essex, which wasn't even down there, really, we had bombed them for 3 days and three nights. And then at the time of the landing, just as they were starting the landing, the United States quit bombing. And that's how they all got killed, you know. But anyhow, when I got Sturgis, he told me the whole story. He told me that he was one of the guys on the grassy knoll and all that stuff. And that's how I ended up arresting him. And then, you know, we talked about why, and parts of my investigation took me into other things that led up to the Kennedy assassination. So, yes, there was a lot of this stuff that we got into besides just the pedophile stuff. But it always came as an offshoot from our pedophile investigations.
So one of the things that, you know, when I heard the story, I mean, because that's a whole nother story to get in more into the Loretta, I mean, Marita Lorenz?
Marita Lorenz. She was daughter of a U-boat commander who had been an American spy. Her mother was an American, and she spied on the Russians, so she grew up spying. Marita is a true Mata Hari. I talk to her every once in a while, yet because I saved her life, you know. Once you save these people's lives, they never forget you.
Mm-hmm.
And every once in a while, I'll talk to her, and she's getting older now, but Marita was also an assassin. She was a true Mata Hari.
Now, I also did an interview with Dangerous Dan Marvin, and he had been approached about being involved in the Kennedy assassination and declined. It sounds like they hire a number of them when one of these things take place. Are you?
Yes, and if you, like I said, we got into all this stuff. In the Kennedy assassination, there were five teams in Dallas. And I personally have identified three of them. And the other two, I was never quite sure, but I have a good idea who they were. And that's why none of the five teams will know there's another team. It's a well-defined thing, and if you ever get into the Op 40 operations of our government, Op 40 came out of room number 40 at Langley, and their mandate was to protect our country at all costs. And all costs can mean various things. over the years while I was working, I also interviewed other people. I interviewed the straight guy for the mob in Havana, Cuba, when Batista was in charge. See, when Batista was in charge, the mob from New York ran Havana. That's where all the illicit monies went through. So when Kennedy got in there, the mob from Boston was entitled to run Havana. That's how business is done. Well, Castro wouldn't let him do it. He says, no way are you going to use my women and children. And he threw us out of there and threw the mob out there. So when the mob couldn't function what they wanted to because Kennedy put him in there, and Kennedy was supposed to get rid of Castro, and he didn't do it. So that was another reason they had to get rid of him. And I interviewed this guy. He did not know I was a cop. He thought I was, I don't know who he thought I was, but I was taken to him by some very important people to talk about this. And there were other aspects of the whole assassination. For instance, the team at the airport was headed by a guy named Big Al Caron. Al Caron had been a New York City cop. He was also a bag man, and he was a made man in the mafia. And when he died, he was buried as a sergeant in a military cemetery. And after we spoke to certain people, all of a sudden his tombstone was changed to colonel. He actually had also been a colonel in the army. So, you know, this is all people that most people can't believe that this stuff really goes on, but it does. And I personally knew the guy. I identified him when nobody knew who he was, because at one point they had even removed him from the New York City police files.
So did you see a Bush involvement in this?
No. Bush's names have come up. Kathy O'Brien and them bring it up. Many times you'll hear the Bush name. I heard it hundreds of times. There were extensive investigations done. I could never prove it. I'm not saying it isn't true, but I could not prove it. And there's all kinds of allegations, but I was never able to prove it.
Okay, what about Bush's involvement in the Kennedy?
No. That was not Bush. That was somebody else. Let me just think. Bush, the part of that was him being in Mexico City. That is true.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Okay, and was there
involved in the actual assassination? No, because that would take a whole show to go through all the different steps that were involved there and the reasons for having it happen. When I arrested Sturgis, I asked him why they had to kill Kennedy. And it was the Bay of Pigs thing in particular, because Sturgis spent some time in jail and got some beatings, and you don't double-cross Op 40, because I happened to be on the bridge the night of the attack. It was stopped when John F. Kennedy personally called the Essex and had them stop the bombing just as the attack started. That alone is enough to get you killed. And there was a book written about it. It never went anywhere, but it is called The Bay of Pigs by some guy named Peter Wyatt, which really gets into, explains. And I just happened to be on the ship. And we didn't have any numbers painted on it. All our jets were painted white, and we were a submarine carrier. So the official line was that we were in Nova Scotia. We were the only sailors that ever came back from Nova Scotia with a suntan.
Okay, so what was their real reason for trying to do the Bay of Pigs? I mean, it sounds like
they wanted to get rid of Castro so that the Boston mob.
Okay, so it was an ulterior motive of a selfish group of whatever bringing the.
Well, that was business. You got to remember, they're the ones that got Kennedy elected. I'm just trying to think of the guy's name. He ended up getting killed, Giancana. Those people got him elected. The mob from Providence and Boston are the ones that got Kennedy elected. So once you get somebody elected, he owes you. So and if you double-cross him, you're going to get killed.
So do you think that tied in with Bobby's murder then?
Certainly. Well, okay. I never investigated Bobby's murder. But Bobby was part of the reason that this happened, because once Castro wouldn't let them come in there, they went after the mob. And, you know, that was like shooting them, you know, double-crossing them, and you don't do that type of stuff in the real world.
Okay. So,
and they thought they had gotten so big and powerful they could do whatever they wanted to do.
So was Johnson involved in on this?
Not that I know of.
Okay. And
that's always interesting. I've never looked at or gone into that part of it. I'm not saying he probably didn't know about it, but I never found any evidence that he had actually been involved in it.
It can be pretty confusing when you get into all the different stories that kind of revolves in and around this.
Years ago, not too many years ago, I interviewed Judge Thunheim, who was the judge that was assigned to review all of the Kennedy papers. And I'm talking to him, and I ask him, by the way, did you see Marita Lorenz's documents and that? And Frank Sturgis, and he says, you know, Jimmy, says, it's very interesting. He says, Marita is such a sweet grandmother. I says, did you know Marita was an assassin? He says, really? I said, yeah. And he says, you know, it's interesting you mention that. He says, there were no documents there for Marita Lorenz or Frank Sturgis. And the interesting part of that is it wasn't that there were single documents missing, but blocks of documents. And the thing is, when I arrested Sturgis in Marita's apartment, those documents were sitting right there, and I looked at them. I got to review them because I knew about 12 hours before Sturgis showed up to kill her, we already were in her apartment. We knew that the hit was coming down. And we reviewed all these documents. And then I knew the detective who had retired that took those documents down to Washington with Marita. So something transpired that those documents disappeared.
Okay, now, is there any more that tie in with this whole, that there were offshoot cases? Now, like, were you involved in the McMartin case?
No, I was. That was, what's his name? Ted Gunderson did a lot of work on that.
Okay, what about Elizabeth Smart?
No. I just saw different cases like hers over mm-hmm. the years. And those are very difficult cases to solve. And it would not be that difficult if the police would know what to do, because there were opportunities in the Elizabeth Smart case for them to have grabbed her years before. And why I say that the police aren't really trained for this, right after we did that investigation when we arrested those 12 pimps, Nixon was still in office. And Nixon, as president, had decided that there was going to be a special team formed to work this type of stuff with the kids. And it was going to be run out of the presidential office, and there was going to be a very tight-knit group because of the possibility of extortion in that. And it was right after that is when he got run out of office. So I often wondered if that had anything to do with it.
I wanted to go back and review a little bit on this Michael Reconosciuto situation.
Sure.
Do you want to talk about that one a little bit?
Michael Reconosciuto, I don't know, are you familiar with the Inslaw case?
A little bit. Now, does that have to do with computer?
Yeah, Promise Software with Bill and Nancy Hamilton. That's how I ran into Reconosciuto. And I'm probably one of the few people that ever interviewed Reconosciuto face-to-face. And I'd had many, many hours of conversations over the phone with him. And Reconosciuto was a super genius, computer-wise. But he had also been used, and he was 13 years old when he ended up in Chile and ended up being a victim. But because of that, he got to go to Stanford and some other universities, and he's absolutely brilliant. His father was very connected to the Chinese government because of the explosives business. And Michael wrote the trap in the Promise software that let the intelligence community at any time they could get into it. See, the Promise software started out tracking court cases and police cases. But then when Michael got hold of it with some other guys out in the Cabazon Indian Reservation, I actually went out there. I spent a month or so out in the Southwest verifying all the things that Reconosciuto had talked about, and they told him he was lying to that. Well, there was a man in Chicago who liked to know the truth, and on a number of occasions he would pay me my expenses to go out and find out what the truth was. See, I will only find out the truth. I will never go out with an agenda. And I actually went out in the desert and proved that Reconosciuto had, in fact, been stopped with they had a missile in the back of a Cadillac, and they were going from Cabazon to the Yuma Proving Grounds to test it. We actually proved that that happened. And Reconosciuto eventually went to jail for being a drug entrepreneur, which was totally false. He was set up. But that's why he's in jail. He's been there, got almost 20 years already, I guess. And he's got, I don't know how many more years to go. So that's where Reconosciuto came in.
And if I'm trying to remember now, was Gary Webb involved in any of that?
Yes, Gary Webb did the narcotics end of it. See, in this investigation that we did, there's another one you'll see in my report where I write about the methamphetamine business. Those guys out in the desert were making the methamphetamines and shipping them to New York. At that time, they had what they called juice joints, where all these runaway kids and stuff, where these pedophiles would come to pick them up and that, and they were run by organized crime. And organized crime was selling the methamphetamines, which helped finance the fiasco in Nicaragua and all of that. It was a part of the whole operation. And in fact, my partner at the time, when they tried to get us to back off of that, they dropped a shrapnel bomb on his bed, and if it hadn't have been for Monday Night Football, he would have been blown to bits. But that's another story. But yes, we had all of that involved in our cases. So you can see this thing spreads all over the place.
Now, do you ever find organized crime, I mean, as far as mafia type involved in the child thing, or is that they just have offshoots around it? I mean,
they were directly involved in the pornography end of it. They were involved in the bars that catered to this. Some of it is so horrible you can't even tell the story on a radio show of what we saw with their involvements in this. Because you got to remember, they were great for extortion and that, and there was big money involved in this business. And it was all underground in those years. The west side of New York, it was all over New York, it was all over the world. When I went on the Oklahoma City bombing case, I was in Oklahoma City, and a couple of the police officers there one night were giving me a ride around, and I said, "Oh my God, look at this." And they're going, what are you saying? I said, "This is a big pedophile operation you got here." And they couldn't believe it, how I had spotted that, you know. But if you don't know what it is, you will never figure it out.
You're talking about with the Oklahoma City bombing?
Yeah. I was down on that.
Okay, how was that involved in that?
Because there were certain people involved in that, and I had been sent down to find out the truth. And when I got there, it didn't take me long. When I saw certain people were there that I had known about, just what happened, and we were able to, first of all, what had happened was 2 hours after the bombing, I had gotten a phone call that said they had the bomber in custody, and officially nobody found out about it for 3 days. And then when I went down there, at one point we tried to get the film that showed, the bomber,
McVeigh.
Pulled up in front of the building, and two people got out, McVeigh and one other guy, and they jumped into Mercury and took off. And we tried to get the film from that. And when McVeigh got arrested, the state trooper called in and said, "I have the bomber." He was the only state trooper that was not going toward Oklahoma City. He was going away from there. And John Doe, number two, had gotten out and taken the license plates off because they were supposed to switch the plates from some plates they had stolen in Fort Smith, Arkansas. Instead, he threw both of them in the ditch, and that's why they knew who McVeigh was. And we went all the way to the United States Supreme Court to get a copy of that tape and the tape of from across the street from the newspaper building, and they kept it under national security. Yes, that was another case I got brought into that came as a result of this other stuff I had done.
Okay, now, when you're talking about where's the the pedophile thing come in, though? Is I guess I'm am I being dense here?
Oh, that comes in from another angle, not directly tied to pedophilia, but to the people, again, through the intelligence connection. There was a name involved there by the name of Issam Barbudi, who I had run into when I was doing some of my investigations where he had been involved in some other stuff. And he, when I got there, I saw he was all over Oklahoma City. And, in fact, there was a lawyer by the name of Michael Johnston who had just beat him in court on a court case. And he was operating out of Oklahoma City. That's how come I got involved. It had it was a very – from a – very remote thing that I got into that.
And Barbudi was involved with in the bombing. How then, I guess?
He was involved. He was one of the people in Oklahoma City. He was also involved in the Louis Champon case with the cyanide. He was involved in the Rapta Libya chemical plant. He was involved with Pan Am 103. That was all Barbudi operations.
Okay, now, this is my question, okay? Is this a situation where he's just going around doing this thing, or is he being hired by somebody within a faction of our government to do this stuff?
That's a $64,000 question. There was definitely involvement. I think what happened there was, as happens many times when you have an informant or somebody you're using, you get double-crossed. And there were some very naive people dealing with him. Again, that'd be another show to go into the whole thing with how I, with Louis Champon and all of that stuff. So, but this is, he was definitely using people in the United States. And how that all came about and how he got tied in with was the financing for different operations. And then when you really got to know who he was nothing but a terrorist.
Yeah, but they don't get here without, I mean, they
oh, yeah, to... yeah, there was somebody in our government, and there are some names that came up that I recognize. One of the names is the same name involved with Michael Reconosciuto ends up being the guy that was involved with Barbudi. In fact, twice he went to verify that Barbudi had died. The guy dies every once in a while. So there's got to be involvement if you got the same guy going twice to verify he's dead.
Huh. So do you feel the same? I mean, do you go along with the story of what was going on with the Oklahoma City bombing, or do you have another twist?
Part of it's true, but not most of it. We were able to reconstruct McVeigh's whereabouts from 3 o'clock in the morning till when the bomb went off. And we know exactly what happened, who was there, and everything else. But Jaina Davis, a young reporter lady down there, a little girl with guts bigger than any man I ever saw, she had the whole story and tried to run with it on, I think it was Channel 7 down there. So Jaina knew, and Jaina did a tremendous job on it. But it never went anywhere.
Yeah, I've never even heard her name out there.
You look it up. Jaina Davis is quite a girl. She did a tremendous job. She identified the Iraqi involvement. She identified the guys that put the Sasha charges in the building. And I was able to verify that. And we did a lot of work on that, yes.
Okay, now, those kind of charges and whatever that was put in that building, that had to have been a pretty specialized operation.
It was definitely.
Okay, and there wouldn't have been.
Remember when I met with General Parton, who was the world's expert on that, and we were able to verify all of this stuff. And the only person that ever ran with the story was Jaina Davis.
Okay, because I'll have to do some looking up on her. Somehow I've not run across that name. There couldn't have been a lot of different. Not many people would be that specialized at that particular operation, right?
Oh yes, these people were most definitely. They were definitely specialized mm-hmm. and knew exactly what they were doing.
Would they have tied into 9/11 at all?
Yes, they did. But the first World Trade Center was the first shot they took. And remember I told you they had also worked with Louis Champagne. In Louis Champagne's business, he was trying to make a natural cherry flavoring, and the byproduct was cyanide. And one of the barrels of cyanide, there were 8 barrels, one disappeared. That was put in, they had to add some chemicals to it to make it bad. But in the first World Trade Center, those chemicals, when the blast went off, were supposed to go throughout the building and kill everybody. But because of the heat of the explosion, it burnt the cyanide up. And that was Louis Champagne. That was stuff right from Louis Champagne to Barbuti, tied directly to the first World Trade Center bombing.
Okay, and Louis Champagne
followed that back to Pan Am 103, mm-hmm. where they used planes, and it's all there. It's a long story.
Now, is Pan Am 103 the one that wasn't Lockerbie, was it?
Lockerbie, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. Because
that one was very interesting. I was living in Maine at the time, and it was in the middle of a blizzard, and I lived in the middle of nowhere. A young man knocks on my door. He had stopped at the gas station when he got off the interstate to find me. You'd have to stop, and they'd always call me. In the middle of a blizzard, he drops me all the documents on Pan Am 103, and I never knew who he was. He told me his name was Bob. And he stayed the night because it was a blizzard, and then he disappeared. I never saw him again. And I had all the documents showing what had happened on Pan Am 103 Lockerbie.
Interesting. And does this tied in with the was it the bombing over in Africa somewhere? Am I right, or is that a different one?
What, the Pan Am 103?
No.
Lockerbie?
No, there was the blast. That had to do with the farms?
Oh, no. The okay. only other one, the Gander Newfoundland one tied to this, and then the killing of the CIA guy, I think his name was Bailey or something like that, when he got killed, they were all tied together.
Okay, I guess what I was trying to tie it to was some of the other bombings that took place in some of the other countries.
I never found out if he was tied to them or not. I don't know.
All right. And Louis Champagne, where did he come from?
Boca Raton, Florida.
And was he, was he like a legitimate business guy? Or was
very legitimate. He was into natural food products type of stuff. His whole family for generations, that's what they'd done. And he found a way to make a natural cherry flavoring. And he needed money to build this factory. And he went to the State Department and stuff to look for investors, and somebody put him in touch with Barbuti, and Barbuti financed building his plant. The only thing Barbuti didn't tell him, he was putting a catch basin in there to catch the cyanide, which was supposed to go down the drain. The cyanide is a byproduct of when they take peaches and apricots seeds and process them. And that's how he got his natural cherry flavoring. And Barbuti built his tank to catch all the cyanide. That's what happened there. And then when Desert Storm came along, the whole thing got blown up, and Champagne somehow got my name, and I went down there, and they were going to put him in jail for the whole thing. And he was just a dupe. He was just some guy trying to make cherry flavoring.
Gosh. So anybody...
And then if you go to Oklahoma City, another guy tied with Barbuti was Moshe Tal. Moshe Tal made a rocket fuel propellant, just the most unbelievable stuff. Well, to deliver this stuff, you needed this special fuel. And he was also involved with a guy named Munden out of Texas, where they made a special lining for pipes and stuff to handle all these chemicals and biological stuff they were using. So, it's an interesting case, but if you didn't know all those things, you could never figure out what happened. Okay. But that was all happening in Oklahoma City.
I'm trying to think of some. There was like another person that got tied into this, and was it where Strassmeyer?
Andreas Strassmeyer, very interesting. As soon as Andreas Strassmeyer found out I was in Oklahoma City, he left. And what was so interesting is how he left. He left through Mexico City. And that is the underground railroad for people of his nature to leave the country. It's one of the spook trails, I call it. Uh-huh. But Andreas Strassmeyer, yes, he was definitely here working for German intelligence because of the neo-Nazi movement. That's why he was here working on Elohim City. In fact, the last guy that McVeigh talked to was Strassmeyer.
And what is Elohim City's involvement in this?
That's where the base operation was for the neo-Nazi movement.
So was it Tony Alamo that was involved?
No,
no, that's not. I've got him.
Barbuti was tied to that through Imhausen and E.G. Farben in the Rapta chemical plant.
Uh huh.
And that was I got a special report that had been done by Simon Wiesenthal, where he had discovered all of that. That's how I got wind of it, you know.
Okay. So.
And then all of this is the same group of people, just, you know, the same, everywhere you go, it was the same people.
Well, one of the things that I found kind of interesting is when you look at who was the ones that were on these committees for like the 9/11 committee and the Oklahoma City committee, and it might have been on the I don't know if it was Ruby Ridge, one of those, or if it was Waco, but you find a lot of the same people involved.
Yes, and doesn't that send up alarms?
Oh,
it should.
It sure does.
Birds of a feather flock together.
And so it makes you have to wonder as to whether, you know, they're there for a reason, and that there is a lot more involvement there. It isn't just this happenstance of some terrorist coming in here all by themselves.
Well, that's it. I remember the day that I got down to Oklahoma City a couple of weeks after the bombing. I got into Oklahoma City, and I went to Charles Keyes. He was the local politician that didn't believe what was going on. And I ended up going down to his offices. That's where I was sent to. And they had a big cartoon in the paper that day of Charles Keyes with elephant ears with a hula hoop, because he had gone with some information that on the morning of the bombing, people at 3 o'clock, between 3 and 3:30, had seen people in government black with hoops on all the high points in Oklahoma City. So when I saw that, I says, they had an electronic beeper on McVeigh's vehicle, and they shut that off at 3 o'clock in the morning, about 3:15 to be exact. So they lost his vehicle. They had been following it, the feds, and they lost it. And that was when the whole thing changed. McVeigh really believed he was going to blow out a couple of windows. But then that vehicle first of all, the bomb was supposed to go off at 6 o'clock in the morning so that there was no innocent people getting hurt. So all the feds were following him, and they were all ready for the bombing at 6. Well, he stopped at some motel, and the whole program got changed. And when he drove up there, it was 9 o'clock. And, you know, everybody made a big issue that the feds weren't there. Well, when the bomb didn't go off at 6, you know, they got to watch overtime. Everybody went home because they'd been working for days on end. And this is, you know, not common knowledge, but again, Jaina Davis knew all of this.
I thought I'd heard that they were thought this was going to be some kind of a drill.
Well, that's what it was. It was supposed to blow some windows out. They wanted the terrorism bill passed. But then there was extra explosives there.
So you never know when you're you're partaking in any of these so-called drills.
Yeah, you're just a functionary, and I can just see McVeigh going, holy cow, I never knew I was going to do that kind of damage, you know. And he's a very interesting, when you get into him, is very interesting as to who he was. But I always believe you got to first do the basics before you can come up with a solution on these cases.
Uh-huh. And did you find many people agreeing with your work when you got done?
Oh,
with
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but not particularly this lawyer that was down there, Mike Johnston, because Mike had taken Barbuti and beat him in court and knew all this information. And Barbuti was operating out of Oklahoma City. When I got there, not one person in Oklahoma City, well, other than Moshe Tal, knew who Mike Johnston was and Jay Atkinson. So when I introduced them to Charles Key and that, well, it became quite obvious what was going on because they had all that information. Because Moshe Tal and Munden had sued with Champagne had gone after Barbuti.
Well, none of these things are ever very simple. It seems like there's so many different angles, or you've got so many different factions that seem to. It's like, you know, you don't blow these things up and just have one event going on. You got
no, and they all follow a pattern, and that's why, like I said, I got down there, I saw certain names and certain people that were there, and they're always there when something goes wrong. So, you know, it's not hard to figure that out. I've been dealing. But, you know, like I said, I was working the stuff with the kids and pedophiles, and I got into that, what I call the shadow government stuff.
So ultimately, what I see coming out of this is if we stood up and held these people accountable, it doesn't matter from what angle we start holding them accountable, and we're going to catch them. We're going to clear up a whole plethora of problems.
You just hit the nail on the head, because that's exactly what it is. And it's that shadow world that's been operating for many, many years. And, you know, I just happened to have been involved in a few of those things. And I ended up arresting people that were involved. I didn't do that on my own. Somebody had to tell me, like when I arrested Frank Sturgis, I got an anonymous phone call. Many of these things, when I got it, was anonymous. Somebody would drop it and let me know about it.
So, you know, they try to let us think it's this lone gunman type situation, but most often
can't be impossible.
right. Well, you know, I guess we need to kind of bring it to a close here, but I, you know, Jim, I really enjoyed this interview. I mean, you've just got all kinds of information that makes one think.
You know, it goes all over the place, but when you sit back and look at it, it's all the same people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And these people have weaknesses, and what are the weaknesses? Kids. And then you throw in all the rest, and you got a mess.
And a lot of money
and power.
Money
is, I mean, the money that goes in this world involving these people is tremendous. It's far bigger than our national debt.
Right. Well, again, Jim, I want to thank you and hope we can do this again. And I certainly would like, I hope I can, I never did hear if I could get Noreen Gosh on, but I certainly would like to.
I'm working on it.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you for having me on your show.
All right. Thanks, Jim, and good night.
Yeah, bye.
Bye. Let's see if I can end that right. Okay. And that was Jim Rothstein, and he's worked in so many different avenues, but I part of my whole point for doing this program again is to show how so many things are connected, and is when we just stand up and start, you know, becoming active and paying attention and working on some ethics out there and holding people accountable instead of just letting them go. I mean, it's either going to take over, which it has in many, many aspects, or we can back it off, back this kind of criminality and government takeover, economic takeover, taking over of our children, taking over our air, our food, our water, you name it. It just starts spreading everywhere, and the only way to deal with it is to start realizing if we start doing it in one place, you're going to get the rest of it.